thank you very much. Thanks for the chance to be back at Islandwood and with BGI, one of the most important educational experiments and institutions around. I'm very honored to be able to teach here occasionally and keep up with the network, and thank you all for coming. With the light in my eyes, I can't see anything but a big blackness out here, but I assume you're still there. Good. And I'd like to introduce a new kind of endgame, and the arrestingly simple proposition that this country can get completely off oil and rebuild its economy, led by business for profit, and by the way, aided technologically by the military for its own reasons of combat effectiveness. This thesis is laid out in the book that Giff mentioned, with forewords by George Shultz and Sir Mark Moody Stewart, the former chairman of Shell. And you can get the mushed up trees version, I believe, outside or from oilendgame.com for $40, or you can download it for free. It is independent, peer-reviewed. All of the technical background and calculations are transparently included in a tech annex that's also free on the website, so you can play with all the spreadsheets and so on. I also brought along a little backup literature if some of you want to catch me afterwards. This came out on 20 September, and it is built around competitive strategy business cases for the car, truck, plane, and oil industries, and around an integration of civil and military affairs. We wrote it for business and military leaders. We didn't write it for political leaders. They can hear about it in due course from their constituents. But it's, as you'll see, it's quite trans-ideological, and our nonprofit, Rocky Mountain Institute, that did this, is completely apolitical, nonpartisan, and entrepreneurial. We actually earn about two-thirds of our revenue from private sector consulting on how to create abundance by design. I want to start with a little economic history. In the 1850s, say around 1850, whaling was one of the biggest industries in the country, and practically every building was lit by whale oil lamps. But a rather odd thing happened. In the 9 years before Drake struck oil in Pennsylvania in 1859, the whalers actually ran out of customers before they ran out of whales. They lost more than 5/6 of their illuminant market to competitors they hadn't paid attention to, the most important being oil and gas, both made from coal. This was quite a while before Edison invented electric light, which in due course displaced the town gas and the coal oil for lighting. But the whalers didn't see any of this coming because they hadn't bothered to add up the competition. They were soon reduced to begging for federal subsidies on national security grounds, and the remnant whale populations had been saved by technological innovators and profit-maximizing capitalists. Now, oil feels a little like this today. We've been building up for several decades a backlog of largely unused but incredibly powerful techniques for saving and substituting for oil, which no one had bothered to add up before. And when we did, we were astonished by what we found, and maybe you will be too. Now, there are two main reasons to want to get the country off oil. Both competitiveness and security are at risk. In competitiveness, we have enough trouble already with Japan, Europe, and so on. But next is China, whose cars will start arriving here in 3 years. Last June, the Chinese cabinet announced a policy of becoming a major net exporter of cars by 2010. 3 weeks later, the same cabinet, unnoticed by many, approved a visionary energy policy based on strong energy efficiency and leapfrog technologies. So you can be reasonably confident they're not planning to export your uncle's Buick. They're planning to export cars that use very little oil and ultimately no oil, because they're also going hard on fuel cells. And I asked a friend in Detroit recently how long it would take before you can drive to Walmart and bring home your new Wally, the Walmart badge of Shanghai Automotive, super efficient car. And he said, oh, about 10 years. So this is a big issue with over a million jobs at risk. At the same time, there are all the obvious problems about oil, insecure supply, and already emergent for a year and a half now, and increasingly dangerous-looking geopolitical rivalry with China over who gets the oil, volatile prices buffeting our economy, worries about what comes out the tailpipe, maybe about depletion, and about U.S. standing in the world. Our analysis values all of these things at zero, which is certainly not the right number, but we base the analysis solely on private internal cost, and found some pretty simple solutions. It turns out you can save half the oil by using it more efficiently in ways that cost an average of $12 per barrel saved. Everything's in year $2,000 at a 5% real discount rate. And then you can replace the rest of the oil, the other half, with a combination of advanced biofuels and save natural gas, used either directly or more profitably and efficiently via hydrogen. Together, these shifts would cost $70 billion a year less in 2025 than buying the oil at the officially forecast price of $26 a barrel, and you'd also get a million net jobs out of it, new ones. Now, to do this, we need to invest about $180 billion, which is very close, by the way, to what we spend on oil imports every year. And half of that goes to retool the car, truck, and plane industries, and the other half to build the advanced biofuels industry. It's quite a handsome return. Besides creating the million new jobs and protecting a million more at risk, there would be a monetary return of upwards of $150 billion a year, so it's financeable in the private capital market. But for the competitiveness and security reasons I mentioned earlier, I think it's worth going to some trouble to accelerate what makes business sense in ways that reduce risk and expand choice. And to do that, our study also suggests some light-handed policies that do not use taxes, mandates, or subsidies. They're very market-oriented. They don't cost the Treasury anything. In fact, the Treasury makes a little money on the deal. They should have a broad cross-party appeal. And since we actually want this to happen, not just get talked about, we figured out ways to do it that need little or no federal legislation, but can be done administratively or at a state level. Now, the $150-odd billion annual return is quite interesting when you compare with what that saves. If you spread the $180 billion investment over a decade, say $18 billion a year, well, let's see, I guess at the present oil price, we're spending that on oil imports every 5 or 6 weeks, and that money leaves and we never see it, most of it again. Now we're spending a good deal on homeland security, I think $47 billion last year, some of which is oil-related and which is to deal with the threats substantially funded by our oil exports. Then we're spending $50-odd billion a year in peacetime military readiness costs, of course more at the moment, for forces whose primary mission is intervention in the Persian Gulf. Curiously, that is several times what we pay to buy oil from the Gulf, and yet the market is attaching about a $5 to $12 a barrel risk premium based on the insecurity of oil from the Gulf, despite, or some believe, because of our troops being there, possibly both. It's a very complex situation. Now, the savings are largely in lower oil consumption, but also tens of billions, maybe $50 or $60 billion a year in saved military fuel logistics costs, some saved ag subsidies, some carbon credits. But I think the really big values may be in not having to worry about oil, because it won't be important anymore. Having a world in which we can treat countries with oil the same as countries without oil, that would certainly create some shock and awe, especially for the countries with oil. Not giving others any reason to think that everything this country does is about oil, not having the risk of fighting over oil. These are some of the reasons, by the way, that the Office of the Secretary of Defense and the Chief of Naval Research co-sponsored this study. Those are all, in my book, very good reasons. To give you a little historic perspective, if you look at the total use of and imports of petroleum since 1950, you'll see the general trend is always toward the northeast corner, except in this funny little period of 8 years, 1977 to 85, when the economy grew 27%, oil use fell 17%, oil imports fell 50%, and imports from the Gulf fell 87%. They'd have been gone in one more year if we'd kept that up. Because the U.S. and other countries saved so much oil, OPEC's exports of oil fell by half, cutting their market so much that it broke their pricing power for a decade. We really proved in that period that the United States has more market power than OPEC, but ours is on the demand side. We are the Saudi Arabia of megabarrels, and we showed that we could save oil faster than they could conveniently sell less oil. Well, we could rerun that play now a whole lot better. We have much better ways to do it. That was practice. Now it's real. You are here. And the forecast from the Energy Information Administration goes, of course, steeply toward the upper right. But I'll describe how, with a combination of better policies and better technologies, we can turn those curves around by wringing more work out of each barrel, turn them steeply downward by substituting some biofuels and biomaterials and a bit of saved natural gas, with so much saved gas left over that it would more than replace everything else. In case you're wondering how realistic this is to use energy more efficiently, you may be interested that in 76, I published an article in Foreign Affairs saying that rather than following the official forecasts over the next 50 years, total U.S. energy use might stabilize and even come down, supporting the same growth as in the upper curve in hot showers, cold beer, mobility, comfort, and other services delivered, but using less energy, better technology, less money, more brains to do the same thing or better. That was really heretical at the time, and yet this lower red line is what's actually happened so far. We're pretty close. The current official forecast, although I haven't seen the one that came out last week, they do this every year, looks like this. It's very much like the previous one, but recalibrated, but it comes out of the same model with the same crank turned. Of course, we now know how to do a lot better than this dash blue line, so there's a big gap in here of whether we have a problem or an opportunity. And particularly in oil, but also in electricity, we've only just scratched the surface of how much efficiency is available and worth buying. We're using half as much oil now as we were in 1975 to make a dollar of GDP, but we can redouble that efficiency for $12 a barrel. And the key to that, of course, is vehicles, which use over two-thirds of the oil. For example, in cars and light trucks, you can save about 69% of the oil compared to the government forecast of what those vehicles would otherwise use to deliver the same services with the same attributes in 2025. And the cost of saving each gallon works out to about 57 cents. Here, for illustration, are four concept cars. So that's from GM, Opel, Toyota, and Hypercar. And these are all ultralights made of carbon fiber. Three of them have hybrid drive. The one at the upper right, for example, is, I believe, 152 miles an hour, 94 miles a gallon. So you can have it all. And if you apply the same thinking to trucks, make them lighter and more aerodynamic and better engines and so on, you can save about 2/3 of their fuel at 25 cents a gallon. For planes, the first 20% is free with the new 787, just renamed, Dreamliner, at the same price as before. And then you can save a lot more, a factor 2 or 3 better than the government forecast at under 50 cents a gallon. And then there's also big, cheap savings in buildings and industry, and often in new ones, the capital cost goes down instead of up. The basic point about all of these is that the technology for using oil more productively is improving even faster than the stunning speed of advance in finding and lifting oil. We've all been very impressed with how well that's going, but the negabarrels are evolving even faster. So their reserves are getting bigger and cheaper, and the same is no longer in general true of oil. Now, the big win is in cars and light trucks. So let's start with a little physics. By the way, if somebody has some water, which I was told was here, but I don't see, I would be happy to have a little bit at some point. Of all of the fuel energy that you put into your car, say, thank you, for a typical sedan, about 7/8 never gets to the wheels. It is wasted first in the engine idling at, by definition, 0 miles a gallon, the drivetrain, and a little bit in accessories. Of the energy that does get to the wheels, half goes to heat the tires and road or to heat the air that the car pushes aside. Only about 6% actually ends up accelerating the car, this aqua bit over here, and then heats the brakes when you stop. And because 95% of the weight you're accelerating is the car, not the driver, less than 1% of the fuel energy actually moves the driver. This is not very gratifying after a century of devoted engineering effort. Moreover, 3/4 of all of the fuel use in the car is caused by its weight. And it's obvious from the diagram that every unit of energy you save at the wheels, especially by making the car lighter, will save an additional 7 units of fuel you don't need to waste getting it to the wheels. So you get this 7-to-1 leverage by improving the basic physics of the car. And obviously, a good place to start would be to make the car lighter. Now, the reason this hadn't been really taken seriously before, although the automakers know the physics perfectly well, is that they thought either it wouldn't be safe or it would cost too much. But those objections are now rapidly disappearing because of advances in materials science and technology. Here, for example, is a Mercedes McLaren SLR handmade carbon fiber composite supercar, which got T-boned at an intersection in Cape Town by an unfortunate VW Golf, which was totaled. Whereas all that happened to the McLaren, despite the side impact, is that it popped off a carbon side panel, which they popped back on, and they'll fix the scratch later. Now, if you were to look under the hood of this thing, you would find in the front a couple of 2-foot-long woven carbon cones weighing less than 15 pounds in total and able to dissipate the entire crash energy of this car hitting a wall at 65 miles an hour. The reason that works is that the materials can absorb about 6 to 12 times more energy per pound than steel can, and they also absorb that energy much more smoothly, so you can use the crush length up to twice as effectively. So this solves the conundrum, we are often told, of making cars light so they're efficient. You can now make them light, but also big, which is protective. They can be big without being heavy, which is hostile and inefficient. In fact, you can make them lighter and bigger and safer, so you can save oil and lives at the same time. And also, you can make them simpler and even cheaper to manufacture, as I'll explain in a minute. I got encouraged about the possibility of migrating these advanced materials from military aerospace uses, where they're low volume and high cost, to civilian cars, where you need high volume and low cost. When I met in the mid-90s a young engineer at the Lockheed Martin Skunk Works, where they do these not quite impossible military aircraft, And he had just led a team that had designed an advanced tactical fighter airframe that was 95% carbon, one-third lighter, but two-thirds cheaper, because it was designed on a clean sheet around the best way to make things out of carbon, not metal. Of course, this was such a weird idea, he had trouble finding a customer, so in due course I was able to hire him to do the same thing for a car with a couple of European major engineering firms for the auto industry and other industrial partners. And what we ended up with is a virtual design, production cost, and manufacturable at competitive cost for your basic mid-size SUV weighing half as much as usual, 0 to 60 in 8.2. We later redesigned it to 7.1, getting 66 miles a gallon at that high acceleration with a gasoline hybrid, like a Prius powertrain, or about 114 miles a gallon with the original design hydrogen fuel cell. Just to give you a little idea of what I mean by virtual design, this is a... oh my. Thank you, Mr. Gates. Oh my. I suppose in this part of the world it might be untactful to tell a Microsoft story, but I'm mightily tempted.
Go for it.
Well, a friend of mine allegedly went to a... from DARPA, went to a software usability conference at which the first speaker was from Microsoft, and he got up to speak, and you could see on the screen it said, sorry, PowerPoint does not support this type of PPT file, it does not recognize this file. And this was puzzling until someone in the audience said, well, you're from Microsoft, I'll bet somebody put the beta of the new PowerPoint on your machine without the filters to read the old files. He said, oh, phooey, oh, that's what happened. Here, let me stand down. Please put up the next speaker and I'll fix this. So he did. Then he went up to try again afterwards, and this time his computer would not handshake with the projector. He said, oh, darn. Look, let me just give my talk without the slides. It'll take too long to reboot. And somebody said, you don't even need to give your talk. You already gave it twice. So anyway, this is an animation of what in the trade is called a Gen X, Gen Y active outdoor lifestyle crossover vehicle. It can look like whatever you want. That's just what this one looks like. It's pretty cavernous inside. Like if you fold down the rear seats, you can put in 2 cubic meters of cargo. If you fold down the right seats, you can put 2 kayaks inside. It steers and controls with a right or left side stick, or if you're British, you put them on the right. Virtual display. It's really a computer with wheels, not a car with chips, because all the functionality is in software, which makes it way cool. Anyway, that's let me not get stuck on that. From the automaking point of view, the most interesting part is there's only 14 pieces in the body, which can all be lifted by hand with no hoist, and they snap together like a kid's toy, so you don't need the body shop. You can lay color in the mold, so you don't need the paint shop. So you just got rid of the two costliest and hardest parts of making the car. The whole plant gets 3 times smaller and about 2/5 cheaper than the leanest plant in the industry. So that's a very different way of making things. And by the way, to declare an interest, I chair and am a tiny shareholder in a small company that has figured out how to do all this cheaply. This is a little tinkly bit of the material we do at FiberForge. This happens to be 60% carbon fiber, 40% nylon, and we can make big sheets of this stuff with something that's a bit like a digital inkjet printer for carbon and or other fibers, laying the fibers precisely where you want them, the right positions and orientations and layers. This is 14 layers. And then you take that piece of carbon-reinforced thermoplastic and heat it up, and then put it on a hot die, and you can make it into shapes like this cup, really deep draw, and that's also really tough. And here's a little salad bowl just to show you can make a non-uniform thickness into a uniform thickness shell, all kinds of cool stuff like that. So we actually had an auto seat bucket made out of a square meter piece of this stuff privately shown at the Detroit Auto Show by a Tier 1 supplier a few weeks ago, and lots of automakers are interested. So we're already getting samples and small pilot runs sold to automakers and Tier 1s and getting into some other markets. So, and we're not the only ones doing this. BMW is moving rapidly toward automated carbon fiber car making. It appears that Honda and Toyota are getting into this because they're in the carbon airplane business, which is a great way to learn how to make stuff out of carbon so you can migrate it to automotive, higher volume and lower cost. And watch this space. Now, if you look at the supply curve of how much extra pre-tax retail price you have to pay in order to get yay many miles per gallon, combined city highway, the sticker rating, the Academy said 4 years ago that there's a range something like this first fan for light trucks or something like the second fan for cars. In other words, you can get more efficient and you pay for it accordingly. That's using conventional incremental technology. Some environmentalists said you can do better than that. They've been right so far but got ignored. Now, the Prius hybrid started here last year, new version. Now it's around here, and in 3 years they say it'll be around here. In other words, it gets cheaper as they make more, which is why you have things like the hybrid Camry and the hybrid Honda Accord, the most popular models coming out now. But you notice the general idea is you still pay more to get more efficient. But then something funny happens. We started that way looking at some conventional technology that would save about a quarter of the fuel and pay back in a year. But then we also used that SUV design at the heart of the market, production costed mainly from bids by manufacturers, to say here's what it would do as a light truck or a car. And lo and behold, here's a 92-mile-a-gallon car compared to the 55-mile-a-gallon Prius. It's almost twice as efficient when you make it ultralight as well as hybrid. But you don't pay extra. You're going to the right, not up and to the right. In other words, the ultralighting is roughly free because it's paid for by the simpler automaking and the smaller propulsion system. There's this whole new design space of ultralights on the right that doesn't cost extra. So these vehicles actually pay for themselves out of $1.50 a gallon fuel savings in 3 years, which is pretty attractive. It's a lot better than today's hybrids. And in case composites aren't ready for prime time for any reason, the steel industry has developed lightweight, specially heat-treated steels that can do about 52 miles a gallon without a hybrid, or about 74 with, so that would start here and in 3 years it would be down here if you put a Prius powertrain in it. Well, that's a very worthy competitor to this kind of car, and it saves most of the fuel, comparable payback. So I'm materials neutral. I'm happy with whatever wins in the market, and we'll find out. Now, if you apply the same logic to heavy trucks, making them more aerodynamic with better tires, lighter weight, better engines and drivetrains, better accessories, you can save on the order of two-thirds of their fuel at 25 cents a gallon. So you start at 6 miles a gallon and you end up about 12, and then with some operational improvements about 16, and lately we've discovered another 1.5 or so we hadn't thought of that'll make it cost even less. And it turns out this is about a 60% internal rate of return for the owner of a big trucking fleet, taking the margin from 3% to 6 or 7%. That should be a good deal. For airplanes, it's a bit more complicated, but the same basic physics. You make them lighter with better engines, better aerodynamics, better accessory loads. We've already had a lot of reduction in fuel intensity, and we've also wrung out a lot of empty seats. That's the difference between these two curves. The government forecast says it'll go on improving half as fast as it has so far, but there's now a good industry consensus that there's another factor, two or three beyond that, to be had at very reasonable cost with what's called blended wing body aircraft that look like this, except the engines are tucked inside. Well, that's pretty good. And then when you combine it with all the other ways to save oil in industry and buildings, if you pay this many dollars to save a barrel, you can save this many million barrels a day. So in 2025, if you fully deploy everything, if you use the incremental simple technologies no one's going to argue about, in fact, they're not as good as many on the market now, you can save a quarter of that projected oil use at $6 a barrel, or you can save half of it at $12 a barrel. That turns out to be a better deal because then you can replace the other half on the supply side competitively, whereas if you only saved a quarter of the oil, some of the needed substitution in supply would cost too much. So it's better to be bold and go for the best technology. But this is only the best 2004 technology. We're not assuming any further invention. I think that's conservative given what technology does over the years. Now on the supply side, I mentioned there are two substitutions of interest. One is in biofuels. And again, this is how many dollars you pay to get the equivalent of a barrel of crude oil at the refinery. Well, what we're used to in biofuels is where we get 2% of our gasoline now, and that's ethanol made from the starch in corn, which is a pretty expensive crop to grow. So that's a small and rather expensive resource. And if you did very much of it, we're already using 7% of our corn for this purpose, and that number would get really big and it would start to affect food prices. On the other hand, you can use some newer techniques, thermochemical, enzymatic, and otherwise, to make the woody part of woody plants like switchgrass or poplar into just as good ethanol, except with twice the yield, lower capital cost, much less energy. So that gives you a robustly competitive nearly 4 million barrels a day, already demonstrated in pilot plants, so we know the economics and the process work. And then there's a bit left over that you can use to displace another million barrels a day of petrochemical feedstocks. Now, just to illustrate the gradual maturation of biofuels, Brazil uses 5% of its cropland to grow sugarcane to displace a quarter of its gasoline. And if you haven't been paying attention lately, you might think that, well, this is heavily subsidized and uncompetitive, and so it was. But they've already recovered the initial subsidies 50 times over from the oil savings, saving a quarter of their gasoline. And it's now competitive without subsidy. It has been for 2 or 3 years now, partly because many of the new cars in Brazil can burn anything from pure ethanol to pure gasoline and any blend in between. So there are no captive customers. They have to compete. And they're actually exporting, starting substantial exports to Japan and China, and would like to export to us too, but they can't because we have a big tariff wall to protect the corn farmers. Now, Europe a couple of years ago made 17 times as much biodiesel as the United States did as part of a deliberate strategy to wean their farmers off of subsidies onto durable revenues. And a lot of that biodiesel is actually distributed by oil companies under their own brand. It's a very good transitional product. The other substitution is a bit of a surprise, and it's saved natural gas. The government forecasts that in 2025 we will use 31 trillion cubic feet a year of the stuff. But it turns out, although there's no public discussion of gas efficiency, you can actually save half the gas at about an eighth the cost of buying it today. The biggest part of that saving comes from using electricity more efficiently or at different times, because almost all of our peak electricity in this country is made very inefficiently in simple cycle gas-fired combustion turbines. They're so inefficient that if you save 1% of the electricity in the country, including the peak hours, you just save 2% of all the gas in the country, and you lowered the price of natural gas by 3 or 4%. So it doesn't take much electric saving to get enormous gas savings. And then you can save some gas very attractively where it's directly used in buildings and industry. And then you can save a bit more by not needing so much to run refineries that aren't making so much liquid fuel because you have efficient vehicles. And you can use also some biomaterial substitution. So altogether, you end up with at least 10 trillion cubic feet a year that you can substitute for oil one way or another. So here's how all the pieces fit together, and then I'll get to how do you do it. The official forecast is in 2025 we'll need 28 million barrels a day of oil products. Well, of that, 8 will go away, and another 7 will be in the process of going away as we turn over vehicle stocks because of doubled oil efficiency at $12 a barrel. You see, that comes to just over half when you get it all done of the forecast oil use, but we haven't done it all by then, so we would still need, say, 6 from biofuels and biomaterials, and about 2 from the no-brainer substitutions of natural gas that make sense at any relative prices. And then the forecast calls for 8 of domestic oil output, not from the Arctic refuge, but only from areas already approved. And then that leaves 5 to get from somewhere, but there's a lot of places to do that. For example, since we're only paying $12 a barrel for efficiency, to displace oil it costs 26 in the forecast, maybe we should buy more efficiency. Or maybe we should just wait a little longer and finish implementing the efficiency we started that's still underway by then. Or we can continue to import oil from Mexico and Canada, or we could drop our tariff barrier, as we'll have to long before 2025, and let in the Brazilian ethanol. Or, I haven't talked about the leftover saved gas yet, and it turns out that's enough to cover this balance term if you use it directly, or if you use it more efficiently via hydrogen, it will also displace all the domestic oil if you want. And I haven't even counted other stuff yet, like wind hydrogen. So there's a big menu of ways to get rid of all the oil if you want, flexibly and very profitably. Now, in order to do this, of course, customers have to want it, policy has to at least get out of the way, capital has to flow to it, leadership and management in the industries that make especially vehicles have to take advantage of it. And we also need to avoid losing those industries meanwhile. The last profit bastion of the big three is in things like SUVs and great big pickups, but the Japanese are moving in on those very rapidly, so are the Europeans. It's no accident that Toyota has more market cap than the big three put together. And we have very demanding customers. We know this is going to be a disruptive set of technologies, but it's not clear that the industry can shift in time before they fall victim to Schumpeterian creative destruction. And really the question is not who's going to make the advanced technology vehicles, but who's, or rather not whether they'll be made, but who's going to make them. We can either import efficient cars to replace foreign oil, or we can make efficient cars and import neither the oil nor the cars, which makes a lot more sense. Now, in aerospace, Boeing has already made this bet. They bet on their now renamed 787 versus the Super Jumbo. And I'm very confident it's the right bet. It's not just about betting that oil prices may stay high and volatile and be a continuing big worry to airlines, but also that the airline business is changing from the fortress hubs defended by monopolizing gates and slots to the point-to-point model that the discounters tend to use. And, Southwest, for example, has 10 or 12 times less market share and revenue than the big six legacy airlines combined, but almost 3 times their collective market cap. Wall Street's already called this race. And a lot of people haven't noticed yet, but the Dreamliner can actually get bigger or smaller according to how that shift goes, whereas Airbus is stuck. They can't get bigger because they're at the landing gear limit, and if they get smaller, it kills the economics of their Super Jumbo. So I think they are rightly nervous about having made the wrong bet. Now, oil companies have a different kind of creative destruction challenge. You'll find in the front of our book quotes from the heads of some big oil and car companies saying we're already in the oil endgame, and many add the beginning of the hydrogen era. But I think it's quite likely that oil is going to get uncompetitive even at low prices before it becomes unavailable even at high prices. There's a lot of speculation about whether the peak in world oil output has happened or is about to happen, and if so, when. I happen to be fairly sanguine. I'm not a depletionist, but it doesn't matter. I mean, first of all, nobody can know when it will happen because 94% of the world oil reserves are held by governments, the geology of their oil is in general an official secret, and they have every incentive to lie about it. That we're likely to see peak oil only in the rearview mirror, but because of the OPEC cartel, we're producing the costlier oil before the cheaper oil, so you can't get the smooth run-up of price that economic theory says would normally signal and anticipate economic depletion. We also know that it takes decades to get off oil just because of the slow turnover of vehicle stocks, and it might therefore be prudent to start the move beyond oil sooner rather than later. But the big surprise here is, hey, the substitutes are cheaper. So the worst thing that can happen if you start getting off oil earlier than you turned out to need to is you make more money earlier. That's okay. Meanwhile, of course, you can have some good transitional products like biodiesel. There are also compelling arguments for changing the whole business model so that you use the solutions economy and you provide mobility and access services, not gallons. But I think the biggest surprise here is that oil companies may actually increase their asset values in a world that's getting off oil. And the reason for that is that the hydrogen in their hydrocarbons is probably worth more without the carbon than with the carbon, even if nobody pays you to keep the carbon out of the air. In other words, in general, they'll make more money, I think, taking hydrogen out of the hydrocarbons in a reformer than putting more into them in a refinery. And as the companies start to work through this arithmetic, they start licking their chops. Now, in order to get all this done, we're going to have to create an advanced materials industrial cluster, turn over vehicle stock somewhat faster, shift choice toward them while increasing freedom of choice. We'll have to figure out how to retool and retrain in the auto industry when it can't afford to do that because of the weak balance sheets, and we've got to do all that before they go broke, which is happening pretty fast. So at the same time, we have to deal with the basic market failures of oil costing society more than is signaled in price, although we haven't counted that. And the most customers take a very short view of efficiency and don't know much about how to get it. And in the industries that make the gadgets that use most of the oil, many managers, especially middle managers, classically resist disruptive innovation. They're only comfortable with incremental sustaining innovations like another cup holder. So how do we turn these stumbling blocks into stepping stones and speed up the adoption of advanced technology vehicles? There are, I think, five main ways and a number of little ways the government can actually help. One way, the most important, is called the FEBATE. That is, when you buy a new car or light truck in the size of your choice, within that size class, there are various offerings with different efficiencies. So the less efficient ones will pay a corresponding fee that is then used to give a rebate to buyers of the more efficient ones. Combination of a fee and a rebate. It's revenue neutral within each size class, and you're therefore not punished for choosing an SUV, but only for choosing an inefficient SUV. If you get an efficient one, you get a rebate paid for by other folks' fees. And therefore, the price spread within each size class widens. This will bring a lot more choices into the market faster because the producer behavior is to keep market share. They're going to put in as much more efficiency as will fit under the rebate. And for the buyer, you just arbitrage the spread in discount rate between consumers and society. That is, as a buyer, I'm now going to be looking at all 14 years worth of lifetime fuel savings on the vehicle rather than just the first 2 or 3 years, so it's more efficient. And it turns out when you model this that both the customers and the automakers make money on the deal. Now, the last frontier of welfare reform turns out to be lack of access to affordable personal mobility. We're not doing so badly with affordable housing. Still a ways to go, but that's been set as a national goal, and a lot of people have been able to buy houses now. The catch is they can't get to work. They can't get to shopping. in both inner cities and rural areas. If you're in the bottom quintile of U.S. household income, you pay as much to feed the car as to feed the family, about 13% of your income. If you're in a place like Tampa, where most of the jobs are way out of town and you can't get there without a car, you can pay as much, say 31% of income, to feed the car as you pay for shelter. You can't do that. And then again, if you don't do it, you don't have a job, and then you can't feed the kids anyway. So we really need a different approach to this. And we've come up with some interesting financial engineering that at an extra cost of $0 to $3 per household per day can get a low-income family into a, say, Prius class, mid-sized family sedan that is new, warranted, extended service contracted, comes with price-hedged gasoline, comes with bulk-bought insurance, and it's an extremely efficient car you can afford to run. And for every car so financed, we're going to scrap almost one clunker, preferably the dirtiest ones, to clean up the air faster. And this turns out to make a new million car a year market that Detroit was never going to get before, because these are not creditworthy customers. They were never going to get a new car before. And they're going to make money on every one. So they kind of like this idea. Now, governments buy hundreds of thousands of cars and light trucks every year, so let's buy it in a smart way that speeds innovation. And there are some well-known techniques like golden carrots that can do that. How about a platinum carrot worth stretching further for, like the first U.S. automaker to sell 200,000 really advanced vehicles gets a $1 billion prize? I like the X Prize. That would kind of get the juices going. I mean, we pay them anyway to do R&D. Why not do it competitively by results? Now, philosophically, you may decide that you do or don't want to give the legacy airlines another chance of survival. If you do, you might reflect that a third of their cost disadvantage is fuel, but they can't afford to buy more efficient planes. So you can do loan guarantees for that purpose that are offset by equity warrants, so it doesn't cost the Treasury. And you can use those just to buy efficient new planes. But for every plane so financed, we're going to scrap an inefficient plane that's parked. The worst fifth of the fleet, more or less, is parked. And if those parked planes go back in the air, they will waste a lot more oil, and they will also block the uptake of Dreamliners now and blended wing body next generation aircraft after that. So societally, those inefficient planes are worth more dead than alive. So we should take them out back and shoot them. I mean, put bounty hunters on them. And Boeing think this is a really nice idea. Now, in order to build the 21st century advanced materials industries in particular, it turns out there's a wonderful customer for this called the Pentagon, which is bigger than the GDP of Russia. And they have very compelling reasons for wanting to make their own land, sea, and air platforms much more fuel efficient. Right now, they have very fat, costly, vulnerable fuel logistics tails dragging behind them, you know, like a half-mile-a-gallon Abrams tank. It's a peerless fighting machine if you can get it there, which takes a long time. But then it is followed around by a couple of lumbering, unarmored fuel tankers. So if you're a bad guy, which one do you shoot at? And not long ago, the field commanders in Iraq were within days of running out of fuel, because that's exactly what the bad guys were doing. That's not good. And it turns out also that you have several divisions of people moving oil around who could be doing other things and realign force structure from tail to tooth. But even more interestingly, you can make oil not worth fighting over. In other words, if the Pentagon uses its science and technology muscle to develop these technologies it needs and transition them to high volume, low cost, like civilian automotive, in order to make, say, tactical ultralight vehicles, that will also transform the civilian economy in exactly the way that the Pentagon already did in creating the internet and the modern semiconductor industry and the global positioning system. But this new civilian transformation is what leads the country off oil, and that's probably the greatest contribution that the Pentagon could make to its national security mission. They really like that idea too. It makes a lot of sense, and it can save them probably tens of billions of dollars a year and quite a lot of lives. The UAW and the Big Three and the main environmental groups have already agreed in principle that loan guarantees, again structured not to cost the Treasury net, can greatly reduce investment risk and help retool and retrain. There are some simple policies we can adopt to speed the transition from hydrocarbons to carbohydrates and start pumping $40 billion a year that we now send abroad back into our own rural and small town American communities. Or as the Apollo Project folks say, would you rather rely on the Midwest or the Mideast? There are also some important ways we can get out of our own way. For example, at a state level, the most important thing we could do would be to start forming distribution utility prices, as California and Oregon do, in a way that rewards utilities for cutting your bill rather than for selling you more energy, which is the present incentive. Now, you notice these recommendations were not about gasoline taxes or CAFE standards. They don't distort the underlying business logic. The idea is, again, for government to steer, not row, and for the private sector to do the heavy lifting for profit. It's all revenue neutral. It needs very little, if any, national legislation. In fact, most of what I've described should, in any case, be piloted at a state level. Try lots of experiments to learn quickly what works before you roll it out nationally. And I think that's very consistent with a sound conservative philosophy. Also, of course, we're trying to solve a lot of problems at once. The problem of affordable personal mobility for lower income households, the need to multiply, in fact, we could probably triple or quadruple net farm and ranch income and wean off subsidies, the need to make the transportation equipment industries profitable and world-leading again, using some of the military dollars that now protect oil to cut the need for oil. As a free byproduct of profitably saving oil, we would also cut our CO2 emissions by a quarter. And all this plays to America's strong suits in innovation and entrepreneurship, private enterprise, to gain competitive advantage in national security. I think that makes a lot more sense than the current policy where we subsidize oil companies to find oil and then pay the Pentagon to guard it and subsidize Hummer owners to burn it. Now, the pattern of displacement, especially for the vehicles, is familiar to any student of the history of technology. In the government forecast, it's pretty unchanged vehicles as far as the eye can see. They would take the next roughly 20 years getting, I think it's 1.5 miles a gallon better than they were in 1987. So let's get those out quickly and skip over the incrementally improved vehicles, and then as quickly as possible get into the ultralight hybrids, after that probably fuel cell vehicles, which are greatly accelerated by ultralighting because the fuel cell gets 3 times smaller so you can afford it a lot earlier, and the tanks get 3 times smaller so they fit. And we've had big changes like this happen pretty quickly before. In the 1920s, it took the auto industry 6 years to switch from wood to steel auto bodies. In World War II, where we had an actual mobilization, it took them 6 months to switch over to making the jeeps and tanks and planes and munitions that won the war. And in general, though, if you don't have that kind of mobilization, it takes on the order of 12 to 15 years to go from 10 to 90% adoption in the stock. Therefore, our policies are designed to get to the first 10% a lot faster, take at least 3 years off it so that you then reach takeoff a lot earlier. It is encouraging that when we last paid attention, the U.S. was cutting its oil per dollar of GDP by over 5% a year over an 8-year period. So at a given GDP, that's equivalent to saving a Gulf's worth of oil every 2.5 years. Or at a 3% a year growth rate, it's like saving a Gulf's worth about every 7 years. And just as a reality check, so you'll see I'm not talking about anything exotic, if all of the cars and light trucks in 2025 on the road were as efficient as the best hybrid cars and SUVs on the market today, they would save 2 gulps worth of oil, or a sixth of the total forecast U.S. oil use. You might consider that a forecasting error. Now, just to add it all up, rather than following the business as usual government forecast, the $12 a barrel efficiency deployed at historically reasonable rates, about two-fifths slower than we did when we paid attention, would turn that curve down on this green line, or the imports on this green line. If you then put in the biofuels and save natural gas, again at historically very reasonable rates, you get to this blue line. And I've just added in gray a 10% tranche of hydrogen to illustrate that it only takes a couple of those to get rid of the equivalent of all the imports in the 2030s, which is as far in the future as the Arab oil embargo is in the past. And once you've embarked on that sort of hydrogen transition, you are inexorably on the path to getting off oil altogether sometime probably in the 2040s, and you have a lot of flexibility in just how you choose to get there and how fast. But just for illustration of what I've left out here, it turns out that the cost-effective wind power in the Dakotas alone, using available land, not interfering with other land uses, could make 50 million tons of hydrogen a year, which is as much as the whole world now makes in industrial hydrogen, and it's enough to run at these levels of efficiency every highway vehicle in the country. So you don't even need to find more gas to make this work. Now, there are a lot of reasons you might want to do what I've described. You may be concerned about our security, about the economy, about jobs, about the planet, about our kids. But I think whatever your motivation, and actually whatever country you're in, we're not the only one who can and should do this, this is an end game that we all ought to be playing to win. I hope that this is enough to start a good conversation, and remember, you can download the whole thing free from oilendgame.com. Free is cool. Thank you very much. A microphone here. Sure.
Amory's going to stay for others to answer questions. There's a microphone in the middle there that is very low, and there's one up here too, so feel free to ask.